Session number 9173, reel 16.
John Vedaway, tape 16.
Since 1974, as you know, Britain has been very severely criticised for not intervening at the time in 1974, at the time of the Turkish intervention, often by people who would have been deeply shocked if it had been suggested we ought to have intervened in 1963 or if we had done so. Not only by Greek Cypriots who feel that we should have intervened in order to protect Greek Cyprus from the Turkish occupation, but also from a number of political figures here in this country, particularly those who have a close connection with Greek Cypriot opinion. And this came out very clearly in the Select Committee of the House of Commons in their report on the question of intervention. My own view is that having failed to intervene effectively in 1963 when the constitution was overthrown by the Greek side, then it was almost politically impossible for us to intervene 10 years later on their behalf, and as it would have appeared, against Turkey and the Turkish Cypriots. The fact that we didn't intervene in the first case made it much more difficult for us to intervene later on. But in any case, was it feasible for us to do so? We could theoretically have come in with Turkey and tried to perhaps to limit and moderate the Turkish action, but just think how that would have been interpreted on the Greek Cypriot side and by in quarters sympathetic to them. Here, the old imperial power would appear to be intervening together with the invader to overthrow the regime in power on the Greek side. Now, not a popular regime. We could have said we were intervening to restore the authority of the government of President Macarius, but we couldn't really say that because under the Treaty of Guarantee we were limited to restoring the state of affairs which Macarius himself had helped to overthrow, and the only basis there would have been for our intervention would in fact have been to reimpose the 1960 constitution on the Greek Cypriots as well as on the Turkish Cypriots. So we would have been on difficult ground there. In addition, of course, although the people engineering the coup d'etat were no doubt an extremist minority, they were not without support within the Greek Cypriot community, and there certainly would have been fierce fighting with heavy casualties. And the fact of British and Turks on one side fighting Greek Cypriots on the other would certainly have had the effect of consolidating Greek Cypriot support behind the illegal Samson regime. Then, had we the troops, the forces available during the Eoka campaign, there had been 30,000 or more British troops tied down in Cyprus, dealing with virtually a handful of determined terrorists, only 100 or so at any time. Did we have the force available to deal with this, with the subsequent conflict, if it had developed in the way I've suggested? I would have myself, my judgment is that it really wasn't politically or probably militarily feasible for us to intervene effectively in 1974, and really we'd lost our opportunity 10 years earlier.
Do you think the United States played any role at all in the events in Cyprus from 1963 onwards?
Well, I think it's clear they did, and this has been the subject of a good deal of examination, particularly by Christopher Hitchens in his book about Cyprus. Yes, he takes a very unfavourable view of American policy in the post-independence period. I don't have enough knowledge to form a judgment on it, but I think it is quite clear that it became American policy to favour what they called double enesis, in fact, partition with the Greek side going to Greece and the Turkish side going to Turkey. And in part, this was a reflection of their rather absurd obsession with Makarios as an ally of the East. He was even referred to, I believe, by American politicians as the Red Archbishop and the Castro of the Eastern Mediterranean. They didn't like his association with Akel, on whose support he certainly did rely, and his activity in the non-aligned field. So, but that was an absurd exaggeration. Anyway, as I say, seemed to be American policy to promote double enesis. This was, of course, very different from the position which the British had taken when they were in control in Cyprus, because, as I have explained, partition never was our preferred alternative. This, however, as far as the Americans are concerned, I suppose it reflected their reliance on Turkey, and also at that time the degree of cooperation which they had established with the junta, with the colonels who were in control in Greece. And it is rather significant that after 1970, the Turkish intervention, no, sorry, after the coup d'etat in 1974, when the British were proposing to denounce the takeover, the State Department under Henry Kissinger were reluctant to do so, and may even have tried to dissuade the British government from taking that step, which suggests that they were contemplating recognition of the Sampson regime.
Looking at the situation before independence in 1960, was there any pressure put on by the Americans then in the situation before 1960, either directly or through NATO?
I take it you mean pressure on Britain. I don't really think so. They were by sentiment, I suppose, disposed in favour of the Greek Cypriots, and the Greek lobby in America even then was fairly powerful, though not as powerful perhaps as it is now. It's generally recognised, I believe, to be second only in its influence to the Zionist or Jewish lobby. But they too were caught in the dilemma that However much their sympathies might be engaged on the Greek side, their interests were engaged on the Turkish side, because they relied a great deal on Turkey as a bastion against Soviet Russia. So I don't think that they really attempted to have a great deal of influence or had much influence on British policy at that time, but I don't have, it's not a field in which I can speak with any authority. They did, it seems, begin to back the Harding approach of excluding both Ennis's and partition, because they did support the attempt by the Macmillan government to reconvene the tripartite conference in July 1957, which I have already mentioned.
Could I ask you, Mr. Redaway, how you feel about the situation in Cyprus today? You know, this dividing line does seem to be fairly permanent. Do you feel that it's there to stay, partition, or do you hope for something different?
I'm quite sure in my own mind, and it's very sad, but I'm quite sure in my own mind that the physical separation of the two communities is now an irreversible fait accompli. Once it has occurred, there is really no turning the clock back, unless, of course, Turkey were to be rendered militarily impotent and Greece took over and so on. But it could only, just as the original separation or partition of the island occurred as a result of fire and sword, so it could only be removed by force, and I can't myself see any prospect of that. How far this necessarily constitutes a partition is debatable. Quite obviously, the island is now territorially and demographically separated. But if a federal system could be got going, there would at least be a good deal of interpenetration then from one side to the other, and it would not be then outright partition. But that's the best I can see for Cyprus. I don't think that I think the Greeks are deluding themselves in thinking that there ever will be a restoration of the former state of affairs involving a return of the Greek Cypriot refugees to their homes and breaking down the line which separates the communities. If there is a settlement, there will certainly be no difficulty, I think, about getting the Greeks to the Turks to agree to freedom of movement, but not to having more than perhaps a token number of Greeks returning to live in the Turkish, has now become the Turkish area. And in any case, it's probable that rather few Greek Cypriots would in fact wish to return and place themselves under a Turkish administration. So I'm afraid the present state of affairs is to that extent irreversible. Another sad feature is, of course, that the two communities have been drifting farther and farther apart now for some 12 years, and this is particularly noticeable in the younger generation. The older Cypriots, both Greek and Turk, who knew Cyprus in happier days, and between whom there was a tolerable degree of harmony and some friendship, they are dying off. And the younger generation have grown up entirely separated from one another. Scarcely any Greek or Turk under the age of perhaps 20, 25 speaks any of the other communities' language. And so this process of separation, of drifting apart, is gathering pace all the time. If there ever is a settlement, then things certainly won't solve themselves. They'll have to be very determined and very energetic efforts to rebuild bridges between the two communities. I can't myself see it that, and indeed, of course, Makarios has virtually agreed to this, and the Greek Cypriot side generally, that any settlement will have to be on the basis of a bizonal federation. That's the best they can hope for. The detail, of course, that is what is the obstacle at the present time, the detail of how power should be shared out in the central government and between the central government and the local provincial administrations. There is a great deal to be discussed and negotiated there. But as long as, certainly as long as the Greeks insist, if they and believe, if they seriously do believe, that it will be possible to revert to the situation, anything like the situation which existed before 1974, then I can't see, I'm afraid, any settlement in prospect. What happens then? I had thought that really there was nothing for it but that Cyprus would end up divided between as remote provinces of Greece and Turkey, which I'm sure would not be a happy end for either Greek or Cypriot Turks. Greek or Turkish Cypriots. But now I'm not so sure. It does seem to me that there's a chance that the existing state of affairs will go on with an independent Greek South relying for a good deal of support, but not crucially, on Greece, and a Turkish independent North relying very much more on the support of Turkey. Whether the Turks will get international recognition for their independent republic remains to be seen. But again, in the course of time, the existing state of affairs tends to be accepted.
What has happened to the concept of enosis for the Greek Cypriots? Is it still there, do you think?
I'm sure it's still there, particularly in certain circles. And the present Archbishop Chrysostomos continues to make wild enosis speeches, and a number of Greek Cypriots certainly support a hard line. Some of them argue that it is the only line to take in the face of what they see as Turkish intransigence. But on the whole, I would have said that the devotion to the idea of a physical annexation to Greece, enosis in those terms, has much diminished and maybe gone for good. My own guess is that the Greek Cypriots have now become genuinely attached to governing themselves and to the idea of independence. But the Turks, on their side, say, all right, you may be right there, but who can say that at some time in the future a new charismatic Makarios or a new violent Grievous won't arise and turn everything upside down again? And however improbable that may be, I think they have a point.
Do you think the Cypriot community in London, that they have any role towards a solution in Cyprus itself?
I doubt whether they have any very direct or positive role to play as far as the solution is concerned, but Indirectly, yes. The London is a place where Greek and Turkish Cypriots can still meet together and renew old ties of friendship and acquaintance. And the indirect influence of the Cypriots living here on their relatives and acquaintances in Cyprus is considerable. I cannot, however, see that the communities here could ever play a very active role in promoting a settlement. That has got to come about within Cyprus itself, and even more important, between Athens and Ankara.
Do you think there was any anti-imperialist aspect to the Cyprus emergency?
Oh, yes, I'm sure that is so, because, of course, it was possible to depict the British role in resisting Ennasis as an imperialist attitude, and that the struggle was against British imperialism. In fact, it wasn't really the core of it. The core of the struggle was for the annexation of Cyprus to Greece. So it wasn't a struggle for independence from British imperialism so much as a struggle for Greek annexation. But certainly Cyprus had, in common with other emerging countries, developing countries, and much more so since they were more capable and more advanced than many of the peoples of the colonial empire, they could quite rightly claim that they should be freed from alien rule and domination. And they were, as I've said, entirely capable of running their own affairs. But who was it who was preventing that? I think on the British side we would say that it was the Ennasis movement, with their insistence on Ennasis and only Ennasis, which perpetuated imperialism, if you like to call it that, British rule in Cyprus, and which also in the end led to the partitioning of the island. Looking back on it all, it seems to me that perhaps the worst, or one of the worst, mistakes of British policy over Cyprus was that we stuck far too long to the vain pursuit of constitutional development, which had worked very well in other more normal colonies as the answer to the Cyprus problem, and didn't give enough thought to trying to tackle the central problem of sovereignty, final status, at an earlier stage when the times were more tranquil and before violence had taken over. But once violence had established itself, I often felt in Cyprus that there was nothing that human effort could do about it, really, that the blind forces of circumstance had taken over and were driving us all along in directions we didn't wish to go. But I do regret that we didn't try something like the Macmillan plan at an earlier stage. It's not very probable that it would have succeeded, but at least it might have stimulated the idea that the Greeks and Turks had really got to accommodate one another's interests in any final solution, and that there simply wouldn't be a solution without that. Even if we'd tried it after the breakdown of the tripartite conference in 1955, it might have had the effect of bringing home to the Greek and Greek Cypriot side the unavoidable need to come to terms with Turkey over the future of the island, and in any case it might have brought about sooner the eventual denouement of the whole affair, and so spared Cyprus at least some of the subsequent strife and bloodshed. For people dealing with the colonial empire as a whole in London, it wasn't perhaps always easy to fix on the essential point that Cyprus was really a very, very special case, and that it needed a special solution suited to the peculiar circumstances. When we got on to the, and were faced with the question of self-determination, and we moved away from simply insisting on British sovereignty, that was in a way a salutary thing for the British, because it did make us concentrate our minds on the essential issue of the final status of the island, and leave aside the safe course of simply insisting on what really was an untenable position, that British sovereignty would continue and the only way ahead was self-government under a British control. That was, I would have said, a dead end. Well, now, when it came to self-determination, of course, for us, as it was for the Greeks, it was something of a Pandora's box, because self-determination is an awkward principle and can be two-edged. Once you open the lid of the box, then in the case of Cyprus, taxine, that is partition, and all the difficult arguments about moral and legal obligations arising from the exercise of self-determination in a country with a mixed population, all of those flew out of the box together with Ennesis. The Greeks certainly thought that they would find the box contained nothing but Ennesis and only Ennesis. They were wrong. As far as we're concerned, well, then we had to tackle it, and we, looking back on it, perhaps it's not too fanciful to discern a certain sort of dialectical symmetry in the way British policy developed. The thesis was acceptance in principle of unitary self-determination, because I think that is really what we meant in the undertaking, in the offer made to Archbishop Macarius. Well, then the antithesis was the contingent acceptance of dual self-determination, the Lennox-Boyd formula, which, as I say, was hypothetical or contingent only if and when the time came. And finally, the synthesis was leaving self-determination aside and going for a different form, method of realizing the national aspirations of the Greek and Turkish Cypriots, that is to say, by developing self-government under the aegis of Greece, Turkey and Britain. We said to the Cypriots, we can't see that self-determination can ever be applied to Cyprus in the ordinary sense of the term. Why not content yourselves with recognition as Greeks and Turks, as well as British subjects, and with all the advantages that brought, and with the association of Greece and Turkey, your motherlands, in the administration of Cyprus, and eventually in shared sovereignty. The British found really that they couldn't untie this Gordian knot of self-determination. They weren't prepared to cut through it, and in the end they just sidestepped it in favour of a different form of recognition for the Greekness and Turkishness of the Cypriots.
Yeah. John Medway, thank you very much indeed.
There's grievous still, isn't
it? I believe there's...